Parsha of Shelach, while of course it contains many elements to it, is without a doubt dominated by the whole episode with the Meraglim, and not only the Meraglim, the Jewish people in response to the Meraglim. And the message we seem to get is that for the Jewish people to send spies was an ill-fated idea, ill-advised. Apparently, there was no need for it. They should have just followed Hashem and Moshe. And the problem begins with the idea, with the notion of sending spies itself. However, that is not so simple. Because we find that later on, and in fact quite soon, the greatest of our people send spies to the relevant parts of Eretz Canaan. Among them, Yehoshua. The Haftorah for Parshas Shelach is Perek Beis of Sefer Yehoshua, where Yehoshua sends two spies to Eretz Canaan. Now, of all people who should have learned that sending spies is not good for the Jews, Yehoshua personally experienced he was involved in it with the 12. Somehow, that didn't stop him sending his own spies. So now the question is, what's the difference between the spies in Parshas Shelach and the spies sent by Yehoshua? And in fact, not only do we find, we don't need to even wait for Yehoshua until we see the sending of spies. In 2 weeks' time, Parshas Chukas, Moshe himself sends spies. Vayishlach Moshe Meraglim, Losores Eretz Yazer, the land of Sichon and the land of Og. So it seems that very shortly afterwards we're sending spies, and somehow that's okay, but why is that kosher and this not kosher? That is a very important question. And while there's more than one answer to this question, an approach which is based in sources which are very close to home, shall we say, is presented by Rav Velbel Soloveitchik, the Brisker Rav. And he explains that the key here is in a Rashi in the beginning of Chumash Devarim, and Rashi is actually quoting Chazal, he's quoting the Sifrei. As we know, most of Rashi is not Rashi himself, it's Rashi quoting Chazal. And Rashi's contribution is to know what to quote, when to quote, and how to quote it. But in Devarim Perek Aleph Pasuk Ches, as the Jewish people are being instructed to move on from from Har Sinai, the Pasuk says, Hashem says to Moshe, or to Bnei Yisrael, Re'ei, Nasati lefneichem es haaretz. See, I have given the land before you. Bo'u u'rishu es haaretz. Come and inherit the land. Asher nishba Hashem la'avoseichem, la'avram Yitzchak u'le'yakov, la'seis lahem u'le'zaram achrihem. Go and inherit the land that Hashem has promised to Avram to give to, and the fathers to give to their descendants. Okay. So Hashem says to the Jewish people, go and inherit. Rashi quotes, and it's from the Sifrei, on the words Bo'u Rishu, come and inherit, says Rashi, Ein me'arer badavar. No one will dispute. No one will protest your entry and possession of the land. Ve'einchem tzrichim le'melchama. And you will not need any preparations for war. Ilu lo sholchu meraglim. Had the Jewish people not sent spies, lo hayot tzrichim l'kli zayin, they would not have needed arms. The entry into Eretz Yisrael would have not been met with armed resistance. And what that means is, if one may say, there's a certain irony here. Because if there's going to be armed resistance, you need to send spies. That's acceptable, it's necessary, it's considered kosher. So really the question, the pre-question as to whether you need to send spies is, what are you expecting to find? As if to say, prior to the Chet HaMeraglim, to the sending of the spies, if there would be no armed resistance, so then that itself makes the sending of spies redundant. everything changed with the sending of the spies. That's the irony here. It is the episode of the spies where they mistakenly sent Meraglim when they didn't need to, which required them to send spies later on, because everything changes now. At the risk of oversimplifying, wherein lies the problem? If HaKadosh Baruch Hu says there will be no resistance, why are the Jewish people insistent nonetheless in sending spies? Presumably, at least part of the answer is they're not comfortable with the idea of just walking in without having made some type of preparations. As is often the case, and it's true in terms of Midah Keneged Midah, sometimes when you ask for something, you get it. Which means if they wish to subscribe to a way of entry in the land where they expect armed resistance, that itself can lead them to expect armed resistance. And that is what begat the necessity to send spies, which means that even two parshas later, although it's 40 years later, Moshe is sending spies, Yehoshua is sending spies, what used to be redundant is now necessary based on the fact that they saw that which was redundant as necessary. And we see, in fact, that this is now the fallout of the Meraglim. It's important to contemplate. Not only did it lead to elapsed time, as if to say it will be longer until you go in, it changed the way in which you will go in. And moreover, it also changes the point at which you will go in. Why do we say this? Because in our parsha, in Perek Yud Dalet, Pasuk Kafhei, so after the people have been told that they will not be going in at the moment, and there was all of the repercussions from the spies, Pasuk Kafhei says, "V'amalaki v'akanani yoshev ba'emek, Amalek, Kenan, they're in the valley. Machar, tomorrow, penu usu lachem hamidbar derech yamsuf." So starting from tomorrow, change direction, turn around. Why do they have to turn around? Is it not just a matter of waiting? Says Rashi, Im telchu sham yargu eschem. If you enter at that point, which is the very point that you were meant to enter yesterday, but if you enter it today, it will not end well. They will kill you. They will extract casualties. Me'acha she'eini imachem, because I'm not with you anymore. Not in that way. And therefore, you need to change and reassess the point in which you'll enter the land. You've got to find a weaker point. Prior to the sending of the spies, there was no concept of weaker point or stronger point. If there's no armed resistance, it doesn't make a difference. They may as well take the shortest path into the land. But all of a sudden, these things become considerations in the wake of the sin of the Meraglim. And in fact, Reb Velvel goes one stage further and brings us back to Chumash Devarim, Perek Aleph, Pasuk Zayin. And once again, those early prokim in Perek Aleph of Devarim are retrospectively taking us back prior to the sin of the spies. And what does Hashem say? Enter the land! Penu Sulachem, Uvo Har HaMariv, El Kol Shecheinav, you can go through the Emori, you can go via all of their neighbors. Who are their neighbors? Of the Amori, Rashi explains, Ammon, Moab, and Har Seir. You can go through all of those territories, Ammon, Umoav. Ask the Brisker Rav, are we not told later on that the Jewish people should not start up with Ammon and Moab? Al Tiskar Bal Milchama, they've got their own merits, and therefore do not confront them, because there shouldn't be any type of armed engagement with them. But here, in Devarim, Perek Aleph Pasuk Zayin, they're being told to head straight through the territories of Ammon and Moab. Why is that acceptable? Says the Brisker Rav, for exactly the same reason. The problem with Ammon and Moab is to have a military confrontation with them. When it becomes apparent that the way of entering the land will be through military conquest and you can expect resistance, wherever you enter, there will be a battle, and do not engage Ammon and Moab in battle. Later on, that becomes a no longer an acceptable path. But once again, prior to the Chet of the Meraglim, where no armed resistance is expected, there's no reason not to enter through the lands of Ammon and Moab, because that's not called engaging in war. There'll be no war. And therefore, as we see, so many things change in the wake of the Meraglim, and again to express it in that way, not only did it mean that we would enter the land of Canaan at a much later stage, but we would enter it in a different way and also at a different point, and all of these ideas are connected. So that is a very important perspective with, again, from Rashi. All of these are comments of Rashi based on Chazal. That's the risk of with regards to sending spies, one could say, before and after. Before the Chet HaMeraglim and after. Now, as we know, as a prelude to one of the to the sending of the spies, one of them gets his name changed. And that, of course, is Yehoshua. Let us see that in Pasuk Tet Zayin, Perek Yud Gimel Pasuk Tet Zayin. The Pasuk has listed all of them. Eile Shemosa Anashim, Perek Yud Gimel Pasuk Tet Zayin. These are the names of the men, Asher Shalach Moshe Lasuras Haaretz, that Moshe sent to scout out the land. Vayikra Moshe Lehoshea Benun Yehoshua. And Moshe calls Hoshea Yehoshua. And Rashi, as is well known, again, based on the Gemara in Sota, when Moshe changes Hoshea's name to Yehoshua, it's a form of a prayer. Hispalel alav. He davened for him, Ko Yoshiacha mi'atzas meraglim. Hashem should save you. The addition of a yud to the hey now has his name beginning with yud and hey, which is the name of Hashem. And of course, Hoshea is salvation. Yehoshua is Ko Yoshiacha. Hashem should save you from the counsel of the meraglim. That's a well-known comment of Rashi. But there's, of course, a very basic question here with regards to this name changing, and that is, of all the 12 spies, why is Yehoshua the only one who has his name changed? One could say that if we would list in order of priority, we'd probably put Yehoshua near the bottom of the list of those who need their name changed and those who need divine assistance in not going astray. Instead of changing Yehoshua's name, that he shouldn't be led astray, why not change everybody else's name, that they shouldn't lead him astray, and they shouldn't themselves go astray? I don't know what their names would sound like, but that's not our problem. If there's room to pray that they should take the right path, so why is Yehoshua, who is the mildest of the cases here, he's the most likely to be okay. If everyone else is okay, he'll be fine. So for some reason, Moshe is only davening for Yehoshua, who is least at risk. And if we say that it's only really the milder cases that one can daven for, I'm not sure why we would say that, but even if so, it's interesting that Kalev is always partnered together with Yehoshua, and they're, the two of them stand upright and do the right thing. So should Kalev's name have been changed? But it wasn't. And in what way, therefore, is Yehoshua unique among the 12? That is the question. Interestingly, Kalev has his own route of invoking divine assistance. In Pasuk Kaf Beis, Rashi notes, as the spies begin to make their way to Eretz, through Eretz Canaan, Vayalu vanegev, vayavo at Hebron, they went up through the south, he came to Hebron. Now we immediately note that there's been a shift from the plural, vayalu, to the singular. Vayavo. They went up through the south. He went to Hebron. Who's he? Says Rashi, again from the Gemara in Sota. That's Kalev. Kalev Levado. Because when he went to Hebron, who's in Hebron? The Avos and the Imos. Halach sham nishtateach al kivrei Avos. He went and davened at Kivrei Avos. Shelo ye nisas lechaveirov. That he should not be enticed by his colleagues. Leos ba'atzasam. So it's interesting. In the end, there is a move at the opening stages for divine protection for Yehoshua and for Kalev. But they come in different ways. They're initiated in different ways. From Yehoshua, it comes from the outside. Moshe davens for him that he should be protected. For Kalev, it comes from within. He davens for himself. He should be protected. But why does Moshe not daven for Kalev and leave him to daven for himself? And these questions are addressed by the Chofetz Chaim. There's a volume of Divrei Torah which were recorded from the Chofetz Chaim. It's called Chofetz Chaim Al HaTorah. And he explains that, as we'll see quite soon from a comment in Rashi, Yehoshua and Kalev both were opposed to the council of the Meraglim, but they expressed it in different ways. And how many ways are there to express it? But as we will see, they were not equally forthcoming and open in terms of their opposition and objections to the Meraglim. Yehoshua was more open, Kalev less so. Kalev appeared to be going with them. Yehoshua was opposed to them and registered as opposition from the start. Where do we see this? Because at the critical moment when the voices of truth start to be sounded, it's Kalev who speaks first and not Yehoshua. Kalev has a voice before Yehoshua has a voice, because no one expected Kalev to really to stand up for what was right. And all of this is found in Perek Yud Gimel, Pasuk Lamed. The Meraglim have been holding forth. It's a land of milk and honey, but it's also got giants, and it's not a good place. And Pasuk Lamed says, Vayahas Kalev es ha'am el Moshe. He silenced the people. It's an onomatopoeia. He hushed the people. Vayahas. He silenced the people towards Moshe and said, no, we can do it. But it's Kalev who silences the people. Where's Yehoshua? He'll come in soon enough, but why is he not there at this opening juncture? Rashi explains that Kalev had people's attention in a way that Yehoshua couldn't have. Because Kalev starts by saying, is this all that Moshe has done for us? And when people heard that, and actually the Gemara refers to, says that Kalev says, is this all that Ben Amram did for us? When you wish to belittle someone, you don't even refer to them by name, but only by their father's name. He doesn't even call him Moshe. Is this all Ben Amram did? Everyone's ears perked up because they were expecting fuel for the fire. And the reason why is because they thought that Kalev was one of them, because he never objected, he never voiced his objections, and therefore they were very eager to hear what he had to say. And we had perfect silence. He said, he split the Yamsuf, in his merit the man came for us, and he's led us through the desert. And to get people thinking a little bit straight, Kalev was able to do that. Yehoshua wasn't able to do that because people knew what to expect from Yehoshua. He voiced his opposition from the beginning. And that is why Kalev is referred to later on as having Ruach Acheres, a contrary spirit. Ruach Acheres means his true spirit was even contrary to the way he appeared. And he did that in order to, he was biding his time in order to find the right time to set things straight. In the end, even that didn't work, but that was Kalev's approach. It turns out, therefore, and it's fascinating, because we so perhaps generally put Kalev and Yehoshua together in every respect. You've got the 10, and they were all together saying the wrong thing, and then you've got these two, and they were both together saying the right thing, but we don't realize that within these two, they didn't go about it in exactly the same way. Yehoshua took the path of outright opposition, whereas Kalev took the somewhat more undercover path, if one might say. How does this affect the way that each one could be vouchsafed divine assistance? The Chofetz Chaim says a chiddush, although it's based on a very foundational point. You can never really pray that someone else, not in a linear sense at least, that someone else should do the right thing or make the right decisions. That's really up to them. And that's why Moshe doesn't pray for the 10 spies. It's up to them. He doesn't pray for Kalev because it's up to him. Kalev needs to pray for himself. You can pray for yourself, because by praying for yourself, you've already made the decision to do the right thing. You're asking for help. That's also a decision. That's a bechira choice. But what about Yehoshua? So the Chofetz Chaim says, and it's quite a chiddush, Moshe can't daven that anyone choose to do the right thing. But when he davens that concerning Yehoshua, Hashem should save you from the council of the spies, it doesn't mean Hashem should save you from falling in with the council of the spies. That's up to you. And you voiced opposition from the beginning. But it's means Hashem should save you from becoming the object of the council of the spies. Meaning they shouldn't start to start plotting against you. You should not become a victim of Atzas Meraglim. Hashem should save you from that. Because you'll need help. After all, 12 people, all by themselves. Who knows? Yoshua is the only one who is objecting vocally, so he might meet with an accident. They might say, listen, we never heard from him again. We went there 12, came back 11, not sure exactly what happened. And then a few weeks later, he's found in a gully or the bottom of a ravine or something like that. That's Atzas Meraglim. You can daven for a person's physical protection. Their moral protection is the question of free will. Their physical protection, that's the question of Hashkocha. And that is the Chofetz Chaim's understanding of Moshe's tefillah. Kalev is not in danger physically from them because they think he's one of them. But they know that you're not one of them. It could be dangerous. Hashem should protect you. Continue on your path. Hashem should protect you from being a victim of Atzas Meraglim. That's the approach of the Chofetz Chaim. Quite a chiddush in Parshanim. Well, as the decree against essentially the entire generation, and again, we call it the sin of the spies, but it is a mistake to lay all of the emphasis on the spies. They started it, but they didn't finish it. They're just 12 people, but the Jewish people took it in, and otherwise they would not be punished. And the original punishment seemingly is presented as destroying them completely. In Perek Yud Dalet, Pasuk Yud Gimel. In the end, it gets modified towards what it became at the end, to the 40 years. But initially, Pasuk Yud Beis, Akenu Vadeve, Varishenu, Hashem says, that's it, I'll wipe them out in a plague, and we'll start again from scratch. But Moshe davens for the Jewish people, as he always does. Pasuk Yud Gimel, Vayomer Moshe El Hashem, Vishamu Mitzrayim, Kealisa Bechokhas Amazem Mikirba. What will Mitzrayim say? We'll say as a matter of preface that Moshe it makes the argument of Chilul Hashem. That's really what it is, as we'll see in the Psukim. Mitzrayim will hear. V'ami or Yeshvi Arts Hazos. And you know what they'll say to the people who live in this land? Shamukyata Hashem Bekarav Amazem. They've heard that you are within this people, but you know what will happen if you kill them here? What will they say? Pasuk Tetzayin, Mibilti Yecholes Hashem Lehavi Es Ha'am Hazeh El Ha'aretz, because you were not able, you lacked the power, the ability to overcome the population of Eretz Canaan, and that's why you killed them in the Midbar. Now that is Moshe's initial response, and it comes back to the all-important concept of Kiddush Hashem and Chilul Hashem. If the world is not aware of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the world is steering towards a dangerous course. And therefore the concept of Kiddush Hashem is begins with what we call a sanctification of Hashem's name. But basically it means that people are aware of HaKadosh Baruch Hu as controlling the world, and therefore they should align their lives accordingly. That the fate of the world effectively rests on whether there is a question of Kiddush Hashem or Chilul Hashem. If it's a Kiddush Hashem, it's a call to people to better themselves, to be worthy of that. If it's a Chilul Hashem, so it leads to complete tohu vavohu. And that's why this is Moshe's first argument. He then invokes a number of the Midos of Rachamim, but it starts with the question of Kiddush Hashem. A very interesting question is raised by Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, the famed founder of the Muslim movement, we don't often have excerpts of Parshanut from him in terms of the Parshios, but this time we do. And Rabbi Yisrael Salanter asked a general question and a specific question. The general question is, Moshe starts out, and we read the Pasuk Yud Gimel, Vayomer Moshe El Hashem, Vishama Mitzrayim. You know, Mitzrayim will hear, and you know what they'll say? They'll say he wasn't able to bring them in. And therefore, we don't want Mitzrayim saying that. And who knows who they're going to say it to? Says Rabbi Shlomo Salanter, why would Mitzrayim be the only people to say that? It seems to be the obvious conclusion for anyone. I mean, anyone who's been following the Jewish people, they'll know. Anyone who knows that they came out from Mitzrayim but didn't make it into the land of Canaan will say exactly the same thing. As if to say, why are the problematic group of people, Mitzrayim specifically, the entire Middle East, is potentially going to say the same thing. The second question, a much more specific question, is if you look again in Pasuk Yud Gimel, Vayomer Moshe el Hashem, Vishomer Mitzrayim, Mitzrayim will hear ki Elisa b'kochecha es ha'am hazeh mikirbo. Mitzrayim, from whose midst you took up this people. That seems to be somewhat redundant. I think we all know by now who Mitzrayim are and what their association is with the Jewish people. We know that the Jewish people were taken out from their midst. If we don't know that, we should probably go back to Chumash Shemos and start again. Which means Moshe emphasizing here, Mitzrayim, and reiterating, Mitzrayim, from whose midst you took the Jewish people. Why is that? Why does that need to be re-emphasized? Says Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, Moshe is saying that in fact it could be that the other nations of the world, anyone else who's a nation who's a going concern, maybe they are less of a concern. Why? Because who says, or HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so to speak, could respond? Who says that if the Jewish people are destroyed, that they'll naturally conclude that Hashem did not have the power to bring them into the land of Canaan? Not necessarily. Perhaps there's another reason entirely. Namely, that they sinned so grievously that they brought divine retribution upon themselves. But that's also part of their relationship with Hashem. As if to say, if Hashem kills them, that why does that necessarily mean or be interpreted as the inability to bring them into the land of Canaan? Maybe it's as the reality is, because they sinned to that degree. So where is the Chilul Hashem? One could almost say it's a Kiddush Hashem. Those are standards of being of godly living. Says Moshe, that may well be true. But you know who's going to ruin everything? Mitzrayim. And you know why? Because as Moshe emphasizes, Mitzrayim are the nation that you brought up this people, mikir bo, from their midst. And what is the connotation of the word mikir bo? We find this later on, because Moshe refers to Hashem as taking the Jewish people out, goy mikerev goy, one nation from the midst of another nation. And that is the allusion in the Torah, or the source in the Torah, that in many respects the Jewish people had begun to imitate the practices of the Mitzrayim. Goy mikerev goy, one nation from the midst of another nation, they'd become very similar to them, and they'd taken on many of their practices, and wrongful practices, many of them. And the Navi Yechezkel says that there was Avodah Zarah there in Mitzrayim. To what degree, he doesn't say, but significant enough to mention. And Mishchu, we're told, with the Korban Pesach, Mishchu Yedechem Me Avodah Zarah. And the Zohar says that they were on the 49th level of Tumah. That's a very different picture now. Because in Mitzrayim's experience, wrongful behavior on the part of the Jewish people does not necessarily lead to their eradication. Because Mitzrayim witnessed firsthand that the Jewish people were involved in many of the things that they were, and Hashem still took them out. Now, Mitzrayim do not have the sophistication nor the inclination to begin to grade and assess, well, there's this level of wrongdoing and that level of wrongdoing and these circumstances and that circumstances. As far as they're concerned, the Jewish people sinned in Mitzrayim and Hashem still took them out. And that is why Moshe says, everyone else may hear that you killed out the Jewish people in the wilderness and say, well, I guess the moral of the story is, don't misbehave. Don't sin. It's not about strength or weakness in bringing them in. It's about reward and punishment. But Mitzrayim have experience in terms of your relationship with the Jewish people vis-a-vis reward and punishment. And they've seen the Jewish people deserving to be punished in their estimation, and you still took them out. And therefore Mitzrayim will set the record straight in their estimation. by saying to everyone, don't think that Hashem punished them because they did the wrong thing. We saw them do the wrong thing by us. He still took them out. And therefore Mitzrayim were the problem here, because they will then say to everyone else, and if he didn't bring them in, it's because he can't bring them in. Because sin, apparently, is not enough of a reason. And although that is a misrepresentation of the facts, Mitzrayim, not then, not now, have never been known to let the facts get in the way. And Chilul Hashem is not always based on the correct interpretation of things. A probable misinterpretation is also grounds for Chilul Hashem. So that's a very interesting explanation from Rabbi Yisrael Salanter why the Chilul Hashem of all places would come from Mitzrayim, based on that motif word, mikir bo, and all of that which it represents. Well, let's conclude by going all the way to the end of the parsha. Of course, by definition, we need to miss out most of it. But at the end of Shelach, we have the parsha of Tzitzis. And in the end of the parsha of Tzitzis, Rashi does something which he does primarily in Chumash Bamidbar. That is to say, he begins by explaining the psukim al derech hapshat, but then at the end he goes back and he brings an exposition of the psukim mi yisodo shel Rabbi Moshe Hadarshan, from based on Rabbi Moshe Hadarshan, who was I believe even one of his rebbeim, or certainly much closer to his time. Rashi does this with the mitzvah of tzitzis, and he does it with Parah Aduma and another one or two places. Mi yisodo shel Rabbi Moshe Hadarshan. And here too, with regards to tzitzis, Rabbi Moshe Hadarshan explains that each aspect of the mitzvah of tzitzis corresponds to an element of Yitzias Mitzrayim. I mean, you see the parsha of tzitzis ends with Yitzias Mitzrayim. Ani Hashem Elokeichem, Asher Tzitzischem Eretz Mitzrayim. And so to every aspect. And thus you have, for example, the four corners, says Rabbi Moshe Darshan, it corresponds to Votzeisi, Vitzalti, Vigalti, Velokachti, right, the Arba Loshonos of Geula, and so on, and so forth. And what about now the eight threads? Says Rabbi Moshe, Vishmona Chutim Sheba, the eight threads on each corner, what do they correspond to? Keneged Shmona Yomim Sheshohu Yisrael, corresponding to the 8 days that Yisrael took, Mishayotim Mitzrayim Acha Amur Shira Al Hayam, from when they left Mitzrayim until they said Shira. So the eight strings are the 8 days. Adkan from Rashi. Now, there is a problem, and that is, if we go back to Rashi earlier, actually in Shemos, describing the timeline of Yetzias Mitzrayim, so Rashi breaks it down, and by the time he's finished, it emerges that Shiras Hayam and Kriyas Yamsef and all of that is not 8 days after leaving Mitzrayim. It's 7 days. It's Shvi Shel Pesach. Rashi says they went 3 days because the Mitzrayim still thought there was going to be 3 days, but then and there they didn't. But they weren't coming back, and then it took those that went with them another 3 days, and then Parah's army in 1 day overtook the whole thing, and then it all came to a head on the 7th day of Pesach. So we're in an interesting situation. Rashi wants us to remember in Parsha Shelach that which he told us in Parsha Beshalach, which means that, and as we know in our own experience, the laying on Shvi Shel Pesach is Shira Sayam. It's day 7. So in Shemos, Rashi says it's day 7, and in Bamidbar, quoting Rabbi Moshe Darshan, Rashi says it's day 8. That is the problem. Now, the Mizrahi, Rabbi Eliyahu Mizrahi, foremost of the commentators on Rashi, here takes an approach which he does quite often, one may say, within Pirush Rashi, and that is, as far as the Mizrahi is concerned, Rashi does not have as a priority consistency or homogeneity among the Pirushim that he quotes. As if to say, Rashi in each Pasuk, and we know that Rashi goes Pasuk by Pasuk. Rarely does he give us what we would call a sweeping overview of a perek or something like that. It's pasuk by pasuk, phrase by phrase, word by word. I mean, that's Rashi's thought. And therefore, as far as Rashi is concerned, osik b'mitzvah, potter ben ha-mitzvah. When he's involved in one word or phrase, his goal is what is the most cogent and closest to the pshat, or if it's drash, whatever criteria Rashi brings drash, what is the best fit in front of us here? Now, very often there are disputes, right? There are machlokasim, and Rashi in one place, says the Mizrahi, will quote one side of the machlokas, and the other place the other side. You have to work it out. But Rashi's job is to explain in each case the best fit, as we say. And therefore, and here, in a sense, it's easier because in Parsha Shelach, Rashi was giving us his own timeline. Here he quotes Rabbi Moshe Darshan. Rabbi Moshe Darshan has every right to say that it was day 8, and Rashi has every right to say it was day 7. And never the twain shall meet. But they're both there in Perush Rashi, and each one in its place, and see one and work out the other. In the Mizrahi's term that he coined, Agados Chalukos. Differing approaches, as if to say, what's the chiddush of the Mizrahi? Mizrahi's contribution to the discussion is not to say that there are disputes amongst Chazal. That much we know. But the point is that Rashi's comments will not always reflect the same side in the dispute, because Rashi's priority is to Pshuto Shamikra, not to any one side in the Machlokas. That's the Mizrahi. Now, interestingly, this question has already been addressed by Rabbeinu Bachya. And Rabbeinu Bachya explains that should we ask the question, was the splitting of the Red Sea and all of that, was that on day 7 from Yetzias Mitzrayim, or was it on day 8 from Yetzias Mitzrayim? The answer, says Rabbeinu Bachya, is yes. Meaning, it is both day 7 and day 8. You just need to know what we're referring to when we talk about Yetzias Mitzrayim. Because the truth is, when we talk about leaving Mitzrayim, what we call Yetzias Mitzrayim, there were actually two critical junctures. There was the day of the 15th where we left, tachlis, actually left. But the night before is also considered in many respects to be Yetzias Mitzrayim, because that's when Paro finally relented and said, go. And that is also called Yetzias Mitzrayim. Why do we say that? That's the reason why it is a mitzvah to remember Yetzias Mitzrayim, not only in the day, but also at night. And we talk about Ga'al Yisrael not only in the morning, but also in the evening. Because although physically we left in the following morning, the following day, more correctly, but politically, and in principle, we were already given full leave. Pirate relinquished every claim on us already after Makas Bechoris the previous evening, and that's also called Yetzias Mitzrayim. And therefore, there are two junctures of Yetzias Mitzrayim: the night of Pesach, and then the following day. And therefore, it could be that if you wish to talk about a certain date a number of days later on, how many days have elapsed, you've got to trace it back to the night or the day. There's just one problem, and that is the day and the night before are part of the same day, which means seemingly it doesn't make a difference as to whether it's from the night of the 15th or the following day of the 15th. They're both the 15th. So how does this split help us at all? However, says Rabbeinu Bachya, as true as it is that generally when we talk about in halacha and Torah, the night follows the day, the day follows the night, there is one very significant exception to this rule, and that is in the realm of korbanos. When you think about it, any time that a korban exists for a day, it's actually the day and then the following night. There is no notion of a night and the following day in korbanos. In the words of the Gemara, Bekodshim halayla holech acharayom, the night actually follows the day. Why that is its own question. But in the world of korbanos, it's actually the night that follows the day. In fact, interestingly, the Alshech HaKadosh explains, this is the reason why we say that Avram, when we talk about the Avos who are metaken the Tfilas, Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, when we talk on Shacharis, Mincha, and Maariv, so Avram started with Shacharis. But if the Jewish day, to the extent that we say that it's already acting with Jewish parameters, etc., so then the day starts in Maariv, so Avram should have done Maariv already, and then Yitzhak, Shacharis, and Yaakov Mincha. So why does Avram start in the morning? Because as we know, Tefillah is like a korban. Tefillah is also keneged tmidim tikno. It's like a korban. Tikon tefilasi keteres lefanecha. And in the same way, therefore, that with korbanos, the day starts in the day and then leads into the night, so too with the avos who started in Shacharis, then Mincha, and then Maariv of the night. In fact, this will also explain something else. There's a very interesting Tosefta in Maseches Tanis, which talks about fast days. If a person fasts for an entire day, when does it start and when does it end? So the Tosefta tells us something which we know very well, but that's where it starts. It says the Tosefta, if it's an entire fast day in Maseches Tanis, then it starts in the night and then ends the following day. How do we know this? What's the source? Says the Tosefta from Megillas Esther, because Esther says in the 3-day fast that she calls Vitsumo Alai, fast for me, Altochlu Vatishtu, Shloshes Yomim, Laila Vayom, night and day. You see, says the Tosefta, the fast starts in the night and ends the following day. Asks Rav David Pardo, who we normally quote as the author of the Maskil of David in his Perush on Rashi, but he also has a Perush called Chaste David on the Tosefta, asked of David Pardo, why do I need to go to Esther? I mean, anytime you tell me there's something that's a day, I know that the day starts on the night and the following day. So why do I need to be taken to Megillas Esther, Laila Vayom? Why would I think this is in any way different? Says Rabbi David Pardo, you would. Because a fast day, and certainly a fast day that's for purposes of tshuva, is like a korban. That's why the Rav Sheshes said, and there's a Yehi Rotzon, and many people say this on fast days, like around Mincha time, he says that everything that's been diminished from me over the fast day should be like a korban that's been offered, miyudomi, vechelbi, the blood and the fat and all of that. That should be considered to be like a korban. Ah, says Rav David Pardo, once a fast day is like a korban, who knows? We know that when it comes to korbanos, it starts in the day and ends in the night. So maybe a fast day also starts in the day and ends in the night. That's why we needed to verify that point. Go and bring that pasuk in Esther where it says no. As much as it's like a korban, but laila vayom starts in the night and ends in the day. And therefore, says the Bnei Bakhya, because the beginning of Pesach is dominated by the korban Pesach, therefore the calendar is also calibrated in that way, whereby the day of the bringing of the Korban Pesach, or the evening when they were allowed to leave by Paro, was following the Korban Pesach. That's shayach to the day before. And that's why from the evening to Kriyas Yamsuf is 8 days. That is Rabbi Moshe Hadarshan. When Rashi gives us the timeline, he's giving us the more practical timeline from when they actually left. He's giving us the traveling timeline. They didn't travel till the next day. From the next day when they traveled, it's day 7. But in the broader context of Yetzias Mitzrayim, it's day 8, because the evening before belongs to the day before, as per Korbanos. In that vein, just the final 2 moments, because if we've come this far, the Gur Aryeh takes things 1 step further. And when I say 1 step further, I actually mean 1 step backwards, for reasons that we'll see. Because the truth is, says Gur Aryeh, very similar in approach to Rabbeinu Bachya, but again, extending it even more. When we work backwards from Kriyas Yamsuf and ask, is it day 7 or day 8? So once again, says the Gur Aryeh, like Rabbeinu Bachya, in terms of travel time, it's day 7, because they left on the 15th, and this is the 21st. But in terms of Yetzias Mitzrayim, in terms of what tzitzis represents, and what is tzitzis? It's a sign of servitude. It's a sign of connection with Hashem. Our connection with Hashem didn't start when we left Mitzrayim, and it didn't start on the evening. It started the day before when we brought the Korban Pesach. Because the Korban Pesach is an act of avodah. If tzitzis are about being Avdei Hashem, the very first time the Jewish people, as a people, were Avdei Hashem is when they performed Avodas Hashem in the form of the Korban Pesach, which is on the 14th of Nisan. The 14th of Nisan until the 21st is 8 days. and therefore we see it's even more, in a sense, delineated than Ibn Bachia, from when we left at 7 days, but from when we enlisted in Hashem's service, which was the day before we left, it's already 8 days. And that was already called Yetzias Mitzrayim. It really is a fascinating idea, which we may need to develop on a later occasion. From a certain point of view, Yetzias Mitzrayim, our freedom in Mitzrayim, started the day before we left, and it started even before we were allowed to go. Because if the goal of Yetzias Mitzrayim is for purposes of becoming Hashem's people, then the step that we took towards becoming Hashem's people, even before we left Mitzrayim, is already we're hopping in the goal even before we're leaving. Sometimes liberty needs to be taken, even before it's given. And that was the day before. And with that, he explains Rashi and Beshalach 7 days with Rabbi Moshe Hadarshim. We'll leave it over there for a second.